This week, we considered the Parsha of Kisavo. And Kisavo begins, as we know, with the mitzvah of Bikurim, of the first fruits. As the Pasuk says, Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Beis V'lokachta, Mereishis Kol Pri HaAdama, from the first of the fruits, Asher Tavi Me'artzecha, and you shall bring them to the Beis HaMikdash, and there's the whole procession and procedure as we know. And this is the mitzvah of Bikurim. And we can learn a lot about the nature, shall we say, of the mitzvah of Bikurim when we compare it with a sister mitzvah called Truma. They actually have quite a bit in common. Firstly, they are both taken from the produce of the land. And moreover, they're both given to the Kohen. Truma, as we know, is given to the Kohen, so is Bikurim. And moreover, they are forbidden for consumption by a non-Kohen. So Truma and Bikurim halachically are very in a similar bracket. Having said that, there is also differences between them. And in a sense, we need to understand why are they the same and in what way are they different. The basic difference between them is that as much as they both come from the produce of the land of Israel, but they don't come from the same kind of produce. Truma and Maaser, but we're focusing on Truma because it goes to the Kohen, like Bikurim, Truma is taken on a Torah level. It is a machlokus rishonim, but according to the Rambam, it's the three species of Dagan, Tirosh, v'Yitzhar. That is to say, grain and grape products and olive oil. Those are the three species that have an obligation on a Torah level in Truma and Maaser. The Rabbanon extended it to all produce, that is true, all fruits and vegetables. According to Rashi, all fruits are d'oraisa, but according to the Rambam and others, it's specifically those three areas, Dagan, v'tirosh, v'yitzar. Bikurim, again, is stated generally, but we know the halacha is that Bikurim are come from specifically from the Shiva Saminim, from the seven species that are mentioned in Parshas Ekev, Eretz Chitau, Sarah, Geffen, Etena, etc. So they don't come from the same type of food. Why is that? And what does that tell us about Bikurim and about Truma? The one who steps in to illuminate for us is Reb Leib Mintzberg in the Ben Melech. And he's going to say something from a certain point of view. It's so simple, once he said it, it seems very obvious, but that's often the way it goes with profound statements. They don't have to be complicated. But he says as follows. Both Truma and Bikurim come from the produce of the land. That is true. What distinguishes them is that Truma and Maaser comes from the produce of the land, and it is a statement of recognition about the produce. Recognition and appreciation about the produce. Bikurim come from the produce of the land, and it's a statement of recognition and appreciation about the land. Bikurim is an expression of gratitude about the land of Israel itself. And, of course, they're both in the same direction, but this is the difference between them. And with this, he proceeds to explain a number of halachic differences between them. Firstly, we can now understand why it is that they come from different species. They're taken from different species. Truma comes, as we said, on a Torah level from Degoncha, Tiroshecha, V'Yitzarecha. Those are three significant areas of food. Yeah, that's in the second parsha of Shema, when we're told that we'll basically have what we need. So those are the three areas, and they represent basic or significant food, because truma is a statement of recognition about the food. That is to say, we give to Hashem back, recognizing that He is the one that we got it from in the first place. That's truma. Bikurim, because it's a statement of appreciation about the gift of the land of Israel, we now understand why it comes from the Shivas Haminim. The Shivas Haminim are the seven species that are so intimately associated specifically with the land of Israel. Haminim shenishtabcha bahem Eretz Yisrael, that the land is praised thereby, because these are the special fruits of the land, because it's about the land. One can live without pomegranates. It's not a staple, and neither are figs, and so on. But these are the special fruits of the land, and Bikurim is about the land. Moreover, and he proceeds, he continues, at what stage does one separate the fruit to become Bikurim, and at what stage does one separate the produce to become Truma? They're not the same. Truma is meant to be separated relatively late in the process. That is to say, when the grain has already been cut and harvested and stored and piled up, ready for now for use, that's when you take truma and maaser. So that's quite a late stage in the processing. Bikurim, on the other hand, are separated and designated as early as possible. The way the Mishnah describes it in Maseches Bikurim, a person goes down to his field and he sees that the fruit is beginning to grow. He already designates that fruit as Bikurim. That's his first fruits. So Bikurim is designated at the earliest possible stage. Truma and Maaser are separated at a much, much later stage. And why is it so? Says the Ben Melech, it's for the above reason. Since Truma and Maaser are appreciation for our food, therefore, they are separated as close to it becoming food as can be, as if to say, it's now ready for consumption. And that's why we wait until it's been harvested and piled, and it's erev food. Now take truma and maaser, which is about the food. Whereas, bikurim, since they are a way of expressing our appreciation of the land, the closer they are to the land, the more that is expressed. And therefore, they're still attached to the tree, just beginning to grow. It's the first one can see an expression from the land itself. That is already the time to designate them as Bikurim, as a statement of gratitude about the land. Furthermore, the Mishnah states in Maseches Bikurim that if a person doesn't own land in Eretz Yisrael, he does not have any obligation to bring Bikurim. And what that means is, if a person purchases fruit and no one bought Bikurim from that fruit, the purchaser doesn't need to separate Bikurim from the fruit. It was the job of the field owner. But if he didn't do it, and someone else comes into possession of that fruit, he doesn't need to bring Bikurim. Not so with regards to Truma and Maaser. As we know, if the original harvester did not separate Truma and Maaser, you know that to be the case, and you purchase food from them, you need to separate Truma and Maaser. So why is it that the obligation of Truma and Maaser is transferable from the original owner, landowner, to the purchaser, but Bikurim isn't? It's for the above reason. Namely, that since Truma and Maaser is about the food, so the one who purchases and is about to consume the food, he has as much of an obligation to take truma and maaser as the one who was originally in possession of the food. But if bikurim is an expression of gratitude about the land, that applies and accrues to a person who owns land in Eretz Yisrael. He needs to make that statement of recognition and appreciation from the food that grew in his land. A final more subtle difference, but everything is now illuminated by this idea. Is there a limit to how much a person can designate as truma? And is there a limit to how much of the produce a person can designate, or the fruits can designate, as bikurim? So here, again, the two-part ways. When it comes to truma, and as we know, the traditional amounts that one separates for truma, a 40th, or a 50th, or a 60th, that's derabanan. Truma is one of those things that there is no set amount from the Torah. One could take a small amount, famously, in the words of the Gemara, chito achas poteres esakri, even one wheat kernel can serve as truma for the entire pile of grain. Just the one wheat kernel. A person's not going to make many friends with Kohanim that way, but it does work on a Torah level. But there's no minimum amount, and is there a maximum amount? Says the Gemara, not really, except there's got to be something left for you. You can't make the whole thing truma, because then there's nothing left. But a person could make all of the fruits of his field bikurim. Why is that? Why is it that one cannot make the entire produce truma, but it can make the entire crop of fruits bikurim? The answer is because something needs to be left for you. The idea is you recognize what you've received, you give some back, and in light of that act of appreciation, you then partake of what you have. So there's got to be something left for you, otherwise you kind of miss the point of truma. Hashem gave you something and he gave the whole thing back. So that's a melacha shein tzricha l'gufa. Why did he give it to you in the first place? You need to give some of it back, but keep some of it, and that's how these mitzvahs work. And that's why you can't make the whole thing truma, because if you make the whole thing truma, there's nothing left for you. So where does your mitzvah land? So you have to leave some that's not truma. It's the regular produce that's been truma impacted. Something has to be left for you. But bikurim, you can make all of the fruits of your field bikurim. Why? Doesn't something have to be left for you? Doesn't the thing that you appreciate have to remain, at least some of it? Says the Ben Melech, it does. It's the land. Truma and maaser are expressions of appreciation about the produce. So some produce needs to remain by you in order to be consumed in light of that appreciation. But bikurim is not appreciation for the fruits. Through the fruits, it's appreciation for the land. So you can give all the fruits, because what you're appreciating, does anything remain with you? The land itself. So some of these are very elemental differences between them. Others are slightly more nuanced, but it's all the same distinction. It just divides the two. Ve'al kulano. And perhaps more than anything else, says the Ben Melech, this will explain to us something that we're so familiar with, it might not occur to us just to note how unusual it is. The mitzvah of Bikurim is accompanied by a recitation called Mikra Bikurim. It's the famous psukim of Arami, Yovei, Davi, Vayered Mitzrayim. We know it very well from Seder night. And originally, in the Chumash, it's from here. It's when one brings Bikurim. And that's an interesting shaila. Why do we need to tell, our whole national life story when you bring Bikurim, but you don't need to say anything when you bring Truma? Other than, enjoy your Truma. So, once again, the Mikra Bikurim, the recitation of these psukim, what are they about at the end of the day? Is Bikurim Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim? We were slaves in Mitzrayim, Vayered Mitzrayim. The reason why we start to tell the story as slaves in Mitzrayim is because how it ends. From there, Vayotzieinu Hashem Misham, Biyad Chazaka, and, as the Pasuk says, Vayivienu El HaMakom HaZeh, and you brought us to this place. That is the fifth pasuk in the parsha. We're not so much familiar with the fifth and final pasuk in that short section, because on Seder night we end with leaving Mitzrayim, because Seder night is about Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. As much as we borrow and we use these psukim as a platform to start darshining V'dorish Me'ari Avedavi, but the relevant topic on Seder night is leaving Mitzrayim, not coming to the land of Israel, certainly not currently. Yesh Omrim, some are Medayik in the Rambam, if I remember correctly, that when we're in a state of Geula, and the Jewish people are all yes in their land under the correct conditions, then even on Seder night we darshan the final pasuk, V'dorish kol ha'parsha kula, including Vayivienu el ha'mokam hazeh, which is pasuk Tes, Vayiten Hashem brought us to this place, Vayiten lanu es ha'aretz hazos, eretz zavas chalav u'devash. The whole of this 4 or 5 psukim section has been leading up to praising Hashem for bringing us to the land of Israel. That's how it culminates. It starts with Yetzias Mitzrayim, ends with the land of Israel. That is something that is uniquely relevant to Bikurim, because Bikurim, as we've said a number of times now, is about appreciation of the land. One doesn't say that about Truma and Maaser, although they only are separated from the produce of the land of Israel, but they're more about recognition of the produce, not so much about the land, and therefore it's not so appropriate or of the essence to tell the story of how we came to have the land of Israel. But with Bikurim it is, and that's why we start our Mi Avei Davi and end Vayivienu el ha'mokam hazeh. And interestingly, this broader bracketing, understanding that the story of the gifting of the land of Israel begins with Yetzias Mitzrayim, is something that we express not only when we bring Bikurim, but also on a regular basis when we bench. Because in Birkas HaMozon, in the second bracha, which is called Birkas Haaretz, it's a blessing over the land, right? V'chalta v'savata v'rata z'yilakach al ha'aretz atova. It's the pasuk that we quote in that second bracha. The bracha is about land of Israel. Nodadach Hashem Elokeinu, Ashin chata l'avaseinu, Eretz chemda tov rechava, about land of Israel. And then what do we say? V'al shod say son, Hashem Elokeinu me'eretz v'nzayim. Ufti son me'beis havotim. Interestingly, here we go backwards a little bit, meaning we start at the end. We start with giving us the land, and then we go back to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. But why are we talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim at all? Is benching Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim? No. But the point is, since part of benching is the blessing over the land, the full blessing over the land starts by remembering where we started, and then we appreciate all the more where Hashem brought us to. So these are, again, the comments of Reb Leib Mintzberg, and as we've seen time and again, he approaches the psukim. We know, we're familiar with the psukim. We may know some of the halachas, and then just the light goes on. I will say, just as a PS, and I cannot claim more familiarity than with the way that I've seen it quoted, but this would seem to dovetail very nicely with an idea that is cited by many mefarshim in the name of the Arizal, who says that the mitzvah of Bikurim is a rectification of the sin of the spies, the chet of the meraglim. They came and they saw the land and came back and slandered it and spread bad reports about it. Enter Bikurim, which specifically comes from the species that the land is praised for, and that serves as the rectification. It's an amazing, obviously, that's an understatement, an amazing idea. And Rabbi Nachum Zemba, hard to mention this idea of the Arizal without the follow-up of Rabbi Nachum Zemba. The Mishnah says, which we referred to before, how does a person designate Bikurim? Says the Mishnah in the third parak of Bikurim, Yored Adam Nosoch Sadehu. A person goes down to his field, and what if he sees? If he sees grapes that have started to ripen, and pomegranates that have started to ripen, and dates that have started to ripen, he ties a string around them and designates them as Truma. And Rabbi Nachum Zemba says, Bikurim. As we know, Bikurim comes from any and all of the seven species. But the Mishnah made specific reference to three of the species. Why these three? Says Rabbi Nachum Zemba, based on the Arizal, that Bikurim comes as a rectification for the Meraklim. So the Meraklim did not only malign the land, they brought back fruits in order to create a bad impression, to scare people. They were outsized and so on. And which fruits did they bring back? These three fruits. They took Eshkol Anavim, cluster of grapes, Umin HaRimonim, they took a pomegranate, Umin HaTe'enim, and they took a fig. So, and therefore, within the seven species, these three have a more personal history with the sin of the spies. They were the ones that were chosen to take them back, and therefore they get a corresponding special mention in the Mishnah there as the three examples of the seven that can be brought as Bikurim and how to designate them as such. But what we do see is, once again, if Bikurim is appreciation of the land, as we see from all of these halachas, like the Ben Melech said, that certainly fits in very wonderfully with what the Arizal says, that it's a tikkun for the sin of the Meraklim for speaking bad about the land. So these are some comments with regards to Bikurim. Much to think about there. Having mentioned the idea of Mikra Bikurim, and Mikra Bikurim, as we said, it's these four or five psukim, in this case five psukim, which start Aramia Vedavi, our experiences as a nation in Egypt, and then later on being brought to the land. And when a person brings Bikurim, they need to say this as well. If I'm not mistaken, it is a separate mitzvah of Taryag, mitzvah Bikurim, to read Bikurim. Now, interestingly, the Mishnah discusses Mikra Bikurim, how it's done. On the one hand, it's pretty simple. Say the psukim. That's all you need to do. We assume that you don't need to start darshening them like the way we do on Seder night. You just say them, and then you set them, and you've done your mitzvah. But there's more to say, because as the Mishnah notes, the reality, certainly at the time of the Mishnah, is that many people who brought Bikurim were not capable of saying the section of the Chumash by themselves. They didn't know how to read. Many people in the time of the Mishnah were in the farming business, and not everyone who was in the farming business was in the reading business. And they didn't know them by heart. And they can't read. But they have to say it. So what did they do? Says the Mishnah, there would be a Kohen there to prompt them. Repeat after me. Aramia Vedavi. Aramia Vedavi. Vayered Mitzrayma. Vayered Mitzrayma. And that's how they would get through it. Very interesting. Says the Mishnah, at a certain point, something else happened. Originally, you basically had two groups. You had the groups that knew how to read, who just got on with it. And then you had the groups, who the group that didn't know how to read, and they were prompted by the Kohen, and it was the whole thing. That's how it was originally. However, says the Mishnah, an amazing thing. They made a takana, an institution. They enacted, at a certain stage, every single person who brings Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash needs to have a Kohen say that formula before him and repeat after him phrase by phrase. To level the field, if you'll pardon the expression. To make sure that no one felt self-conscious or embarrassed that they couldn't read. You shouldn't have the people in the illiterate line waiting to be prompted, whereas whoever could read, so then they just do it themselves. In order that no one should, you can't tell who can read, who can't read. Everyone has a Kohen say before it. It took more time, and it was time well spent. It's worth it. So you could have people that didn't know how to read, they were prompted by a Kohen. You could have people who didn't know how to read, they're prompted by a Kohen. You could have someone, he may have been the bar mitzvah teacher of this Kohen in question. He's also prompted by the Kohen. Shelo levayish. Not to shame a person who doesn't know how to read. Interestingly, in some communities, there was an echo of this idea, and it became a minhag there. This is mentioned by Rabbeinu Bachya in his Perush on the Torah. We know that originally, when everyone was fluent in the Chumash, And who didn't know Chumash, who came to Shul? When you were called to the Torah, you read that part. Everyone knew everything in the Chumash. You could, at the drop of a hat, you get Revi, you get Chamishi. It could be that most people practiced more for Shlishi, but where whatever you were called up for, you could read. At a certain point, that was no longer the case on a widespread level, and there emerged the institution which is called a Baal Kore. Baal Kore, that is to say, with an ayin, important to emphasize. Baal Kore means he knows how to read. Baal Kore without an ayin means he doesn't know how to read. So the Baal Kore, he now is he's the laner. And everyone is fine, everyone can relax. He needs to know what the parsha, how to read the parsha. No one else does. The question is, what if a person happens to yes know that parsha? What if it's his bar mitzvah parsha? Or what if he's a Kohen, but he doesn't know the whole parsha, but he knows Rishon, because he learns on Monday and Thursday. So he doesn't need the Baal Kore. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, based on the Minag, based on this Mishnah in Bikurim, is no one can read for themselves, even if you know it. Because you're just highlighting the fact that everyone else doesn't know it. Everyone relies on the Baal Kore, even those who know their parshas. That's an amazing landing from this takona in Bikurim. Everyone is prompted, even those who know how to read. Everyone listens to the Baal Kore, even a person who actually knows, happens to know that section. Very interesting. Now, there is a follow-up, an ensuing Mishnah there in Bikurim, which talks also about different practices. The Pasuk says that the Bikurim need to be brought in a basket, which itself is very interesting. The Pasuk never specifies how any other gifts need to be given. Your Truma and Maaser, give them however whatever contains them. But when it comes to Bikurim, it's a tene, it's a basket, and so be it. What is the basket made of? Doesn't say. Okay. So what is it made of? Says the Mishnah. It depends. It depends what a person can afford. Those who were of means, those who were wealthy, so as they would bring their Bikurim in baskets of gold and silver. Very nice. Now not everyone can afford that. And if you were just a regular person, or those that were poorer, so they would bring it in a regular basket. And that's that. So once again, we have a kind of a disparity. And I remember, and this is going back probably about 40 years, my father, Zatzal, Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, I happened to be in our shul, and he gave a sermon. And he asked, so what's coming next? I think we all know what's coming next. People are going to be embarrassed. And therefore, there is a follow-up takana that everyone needs to bring in a basket of straw so as not to embarrass people that don't have gold and silver. But actually, there was never such an enactment made. It just stayed that whatever you could afford, that's what you brought. And if you could afford gold and silver, you bring a gold and silver. And if you couldn't, you didn't. And of course, there's a glaring absence here. Why do we not have the unifying, leveling enactment that everyone should go to the lowest common denominator of wicker work for the basket, just like we have that everyone goes to the lowest common denominator and is prompted by the Kohen, so as not to embarrass a person that can't read? There should be this corresponding enactment not to embarrass a person that doesn't have gold and silver. And the answer that he gave was, it basically emerges from the question. Here we are being told that if you don't have gold and silver, you don't have to be ashamed. If you can't read Hebrew, you should be ashamed. Now, we'll spare you that shame. We don't want you to be ashamed. But that's something that's worth being ashamed about. But not having the gold and the silver for the basket, it's not something worth being ashamed about. And what's amazing is, if one can ponder this for a moment, there was more validation and empowerment for the poor by not making a takana that everyone should have the just bring wicker work than if they would have yes made a takana. Because if they yes made a takana, we're saying, oh, you poor thing, you can't, you must be desperately embarrassed, we'll spare you the shame. But here, the rabbi said more than that. It doesn't matter. Can you read? If you can, you're fine. If you can't, then we'll talk. And we'll talk about sparing shame. So the non-enactment was as profound as the yes enactment about reading. And this now becomes a defining question for the Jew. How does one find the person, the person's priorities and the ideas closest to his heart? By asking this question, what is he embarrassed over that he doesn't have? Gold and silver? The latest whatever it is? Or he doesn't have Torah knowledge, he doesn't know Mishnayos, he doesn't know Gemara, he doesn't know Chumash, he doesn't know... It defines the person. What is he embarrassed over that he doesn't have? And this really segues into, in a sense, the corresponding question, again, that defines the person. We're mindful, take ourselves over to Parshas Vayeshev, to the Beis Halevi, with regards to the dreams of Yosef. And what do we find there? Yosef has the two dreams that are recorded at the beginning of Vayeshev with the bundles of wheat and with the sun, moon, and stars. And as we know, the brothers reacted negatively to both dreams. But at the same time, the negative reaction was not the same. If we look closely at the psukim, we will see that after the first dream with the bundles of wheat, the pasuk says, "Vayosifu od sino oso sina sin nun aleph." They hated him. It's a strong term, but that's what the Torah uses. And over this first dream, they reacted with sina. With the second dream, the sun, moon, and stars, the verse concludes, "Vayikanu bo echav." The brothers were jealous of Yosef. And that's very interesting. The two dreams are kind of the same. Yosef's in the middle, and the brothers are around, and bowing down. But the first dream, they responded with sina, by Yosefu sino oso, and the second dream with kina, by Yikanu bo echav. What is the difference between them? Says the Beis Halevi, these two dreams are similar in message, but not exactly the same. I mean, there's two of them, and they aren't the same. But what is the difference between them? They represent the centrality of Yosef, the primacy and ascendancy of Yosef in two different spheres, as the content of the dream suggests. The first dream is it's about wheat in the field, and that means that at a certain point, the brothers will become subservient to Yosef over physical sustenance, wheat, which indeed they were. The second dream is in a different domain. It's in a different sphere. It's the sun, moon, and stars. It's the heavenly sphere. That means that in terms of even more elevated matters, the brothers will also be secondary to Yosef, and he will be primary. And therefore, to sum up, the first dream says that Yosef will be primary with regards to physical possessions, and the second dream is that Yosef will be central and primary with regards to spiritual possessions. And now, says the Beis Halevi, understand why the brothers reacted to each dream in the way they did. The first dream says the Torah, "Vayosifu od sino oso." They hated him. Now, hatred is not a good response. It's a negative response. But one thing's for sure, they weren't jealous of him. To teach us what? That even if it's really true that so-and-so has more wheat than you, it's not something to be jealous over. The brothers will never be jealous that someone has more wheat than them. On the contrary, Vayosifu od sino oso, they were disdainful towards him. Who dreams about wheat? That's the stuff of dreams. So there was only sina there, contempt. One doesn't want to use the wrong word, but that's the direction that it was. The second dream, in heavenly matters, the sun, moon, and stars, on a higher level, he's also central there. Now we find Vayikan ubo echav. The brothers are jealous of Yosef. It doesn't mean they should have reacted the way they did and responded practically the way they did, but one thing we do learn from there, what is worth being jealous over? If a person's star is if you're secondary in spiritual terms, it's worth being jealous in the right way. But more wheat, that's not grounds for jealousy. And it's in a sense, again, it's the same defining question. As surely as we see from Bikurim, that you find a person when you say, what are they embarrassed that they don't have? You'll likewise find them when you say, what are you jealous over that someone else has that you don't have? Is it there? Is it a machine? Is it a device? Or is it character traits? And is it Torah knowledge? And so on. I'll mention just in conclusion of this, a story that took place with Reb Chaim Kanievsky. It's a brief exchange, as were most of his exchanges. Reb Chaim Kanievsky received dozens, if not hundreds of people on a daily basis. And he's also trying to learn the whole time, so he made time for everyone, but he would err on the side of brevity. That's as a matter of course. Either way, but people would ask him anything. And one person came to Reb Chaim Kanievsky and says, I want a brocha or an eitzah to protect myself from ayin hara, from the evil eye. Said Reb Chaim Kanievsky, why are you afraid of the evil eye? What's happening? So this person says, I have a lot of money, and other people around me, they don't have so much money. I'm worried they'll be jealous of me. They'll give me an ayin hara. My money is very important. Will you help protect me from an ayin hara? So Reb Chaim said to him, do you set aside time for learning? And the person said, and to his credit, honestly, not really, because whenever I can, I'm working because I want to make as much money as I can. So Reb Chaim said, okay, so whenever you can, you work. All you do is earn money to get as much as you can, and you don't learn anything. I'll be honest with you. I don't think you need to worry about ayin hara. I don't think anyone would be jealous of being like you. All you do is work to make more money. Who's going to be jealous over that? So, of course, with all the disclaimers and provisos, parnasa is parnasa, and so on. But a person who turned his occupation into preoccupation, says Reb Chaim, don't worry. No, people might pity you. No one's going to be jealous of you. And that really echoes the theme that we see from Bikurim and from Yosef's dreams. Let's move on a little further into the parsha. And we have, again, these are parshas that really need to be studied carefully. There's so much there, so many details and questions. But we have in the beginning of Perek Kaf Zayin, the writing of the Torah on stones. And let's see, Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Beis. V'haya, b'yom asher tavru es ha-yarden, on the day that you cross the Yarden, el ha-aretz asher shem lakecha nosin lach, so when you cross the Yarden into the land of Israel, v'akimosu lecha avonim gedolos, v'sadata osam basid, you shall set up these big stones, and you should write the Torah on them, as Pasuk Gimel says, v'chasavta lehen, it's called divrei ha-Torah hazos. This is a major question in the Rishonim, how much of the Torah was written on these stones? The whole thing? Or maybe a Saras Adibros, but either way, certainly they have Torah written on them. The Abarbanel famously refers to these stones as the mezuzah of the land of Israel. So that's Pasuk Beis. Now, Pasuk Dalad reads, V'hayaba avrechem es ha-yarden, when you cross the Yarden, takimu es avonim ha-eile, ashonach mitzaves chem ayom b'harivam, you shall set up these stones. On a simple level, Pasuk Dalet seems to be a repetition of Pasuk Beis, effectively, a reiteration. Pasuk Beis is when you pass through the Yarden, set up these stones, and set up Pasuk Beis. So Pasuk Dalet says the same thing. What is between them? Are they both referring to the same thing? Rashi says no. Rashi, citing the Medrash, tells us that actually these are two sets of stones. Pasuk Beis, which talks about setting up stones when you pass through the Yarden, were actually stones that were set up in the Yarden. We know the Jordan River split for them, or more correctly, ceased to flow, which created a place for them to pass by. Within that place, they set up stones that we're discussing. That's Pasuk Beis. They also took additional stones to Har Eval. That is Pasuk Dalet. Again, to be clear, the two psukim of Beis and Dalet are two separate sets of stones. They're not two references to the same set. Set number one is in the Yarden itself, in the riverbed. How much time do they have to write? I don't know. Enough. And the second Pasuk Dalet is the second set, which were taken to Har Eval. That is Rashi's, again, based on Chazal, response to these two psukim. And Meshech Chochma comes and raises a simple question. And that is, this could have been more explicit. They both sound very similar. When you pass through the Yarden, set up stones, the Torah could have explicated a little more and said, these should be written in the Yarden, these should be taken to Harva. It's a little open-ended. Of course, if you're sensitive to repetition and nuance, but why should a message like this be left to nuance? Be left in the world of remez, effectively. You almost have to read between the lines. You didn't spell it out. Why is that so? An interesting shaila of Meshech Chochma. And of course, he asks the question because he has the answer. And Meshech Chochma says an amazing thing. It's based on the Rambam, as we know. Meshech Chochma has a special affinity for Rambam. And when the Rambam talks about why we believe that Moshe is the chosen emissary of Hashem, the Rambam says it's not because of the miracles that Moshe performed. Because miracles aren't for that. After all, if one's looking for absolute veracity, even a miracle, a person can be second-guessing if he wants. So miracles are not for verification purposes. You know why we believe that Moshe is Hashem's emissary? Because we all heard Hashem talk to Moshe and tell him to relay the Torah to the Jewish people in Parshas Yisro. And that's not what miracles are for. What are miracles for then? Miracles serve a need, subject to necessity. If you need a miracle, which means that we're in the desert and we need food, so then if you need food and there's none naturally available, so food will become unnaturally available. That's called the man. If you're stuck by the Yam Suf and you can't get through, so then you need a miracle. Subject to requirement. That's Rambam's take on miracles. Miracles are subject to requirement. Now, with that in mind, let us consider the miracle of the splitting of the River Jordan. What's the goal? Now, here we should appreciate it's not like the Yam Suf. We didn't have the wherewithal to get through the Yam Suf when the Egyptians were chasing behind us. There is no choice but to split it. But most people have crossed the Jordan River without it splitting before them. It can be done. And it could take a little bit more time. We have time. We've been heading there for 40 years. So if it takes a day as opposed to an hour or whatever it might be, it can be done. So what's the purpose of this miracle? Says Meshech Chochma, the purpose of the miracle of splitting the Yarden is that you're about to enter the land, and you're about to wage war against the inhabitants of the land. This is to weaken the morale of the inhabitants of the land. When they see or know or hear that the way that you entered the land is that it's split before you, that's going to change their resolve and weaken it somewhat. Not totally, but significantly. And that's the purpose of this miracle. It's a prelude to war. War begins in the mind of the enemy before you meet them on the battlefield. That's the purpose of this miracle, to prepare for war. There's just one shaila. Was war an inevitability? Was it something that was always definitely going to happen? Says Meshech Chochma, according to the Yerushalmi, no. The Yerushalmi in Maseches Shavuos, it's a famous section of the of the Yerushalmi. That says that Yeshua sent a message to the inhabitants of the land of Israel and gave them options. He says, we are coming. This is our land. You have the following options. You can either vacate, or you can make peace with us, but you've got to be prepared to live within our land, or you can wage war against us. But we're giving you those three possibilities. In the event, as we know, although if I'm not mistaken, the Yerushalmi says that one of the nations, they did leave. But most of them stayed. But what this means is, amazingly, at the time that this pasuk is said, the war against these nations did not have to happen. It was not an inevitability. We need to be prepared for it if it is to happen. But it didn't have to happen. Had the nations of the land all responded and said, we'd like to make peace, or we don't want trouble, either we'll leave, or you're welcome, or whatever it is. Now, they didn't do that. But had they done that, there would have been no war. But that's very interesting, because putting ourselves in that situation, had there been no need for war, there would also be no need for the Jordan River to split. We could just cross it like everybody else. You don't have to weaken anyone's morale. No one's going to war against you. So that's very interesting, because it's only one historical option to be taken, which would then necessitate the miracle of the splitting of the Yarden. Needless to say, if the Yarden isn't split, there's no meaning to be writing the Torah on stones in the riverbed. Putting this all together, says Meshech Chochma, what this means is, in Parshas Kisavo, before Yeshua has sent the message, so we're going back in time, and from back in time, looking ahead, where will the Torah be written? On which stones? They will for sure be written on the stones in Har Eval, no question about that. Will there be this additional writing? Hard to say. Because the additional writing would take place in the riverbed of the Yarden, which will only happen if the Yarden splits, which itself will only happen if the nations choose war, but they haven't been given the choice yet. And that is why, says Meshech Chochma, the Torah at this stage does not explicitly say that it should be writing on the stones in the riverbed. Because had the Torah said it explicitly, at that point, pardon me, it would have been set in stone. And it would be irrevocable. But that would cause complications, because this is a response to a decision that hasn't been made yet and might not be made. So we know that foreknowledge and free will doesn't work that way. We can't be acting on foreknowledge when people still have free will. And that is why the whole notion that there might be writing on the stones in the riverbed is left in the world of illusion, it's left in the world of remez, but it is not spelled out black on white in the Torah. A very fascinating answer of Meshech Chochma. And still, one may say, there's room to press and to ask. You know, an illusion is also something. As if to say, if we may ask the question this way, what would have happened to that illusion had this not been necessary? It would have just been an illusion levatala. It's just there, never to be picked up. I believe that perhaps we may suggest that the difference between an illusion and something that is explicated is not just that one is stated clearly and one is stated less clearly. It's more than that. The less explicit it is, the more flexible it is to be taken as an illusion for different things. The more it explicitly states A, it can only be A. But if it's an illusion, for example, it's a repetition of the pasuk, the repetition of a pasuk may mean all sorts of things. As we proceed, we discover which is the signal that clearly is emerging. But had things turned out differently, perhaps it would have been a different signal. That latitude of signaling can only happen if it's a signal. If it's beremes, it's a bit more malleable. So the remes would never have gone to waste. It might have been understood as being a remes to something else. So you preserve that scope to be prepared for the unknown yet when things remain. And my reason for saying this or suggesting this, it's based on a comment of Rav Gedalia Shor, Zatzal, in the Ur Gedaliyahu, in Parshas Toldos. And there, we're told about Yaakov and Esav. That's what Toldos is about. As we know, both Yishmael and Esav are not considered halachically, that is to say, meaningfully, descended from Avram Avinu. How do we see this? Hashem says to Avram, how do we know that Yishmael is excluded? Because Hashem says to Avram, and it's going to be the Kriyas HaTorah for Rosh Hashanah, first day Rosh Hashanah. Ki v'Yitzchak yikar lechazara. Only Yitzchak will be considered your progeny. Not Yishmael. Sarah says send him away. Avram didn't want to send him away. Hashem says send him away. He's not in this regard considered to be your progeny. Only Yitzchak. Ki v'Yitzchak yikar lechazara. So based on that pasuk, Yishmael is excluded as being called Zera Avram, the progeny or descendant of Avram. But what about Esav? Is he also excluded? Yes, but he's from Yitzchak. So how is he excluded from this pasuk? Says the Gemara, it's a Gemara Nedarim, because the pasuk says, Ki b'Yitzchak. B'Yitzchak means within Yitzchak. There's someone within Yitzchak that will be Zera, your progeny, meaning not all of Yitzchak's descendants, but someone within him, Yaakov, and not Esav. And that is how we exclude Yishmael and Esav. This also has ramifications for the Nusach of Tefillah on Rosh Hashanah, because the middle bracha of Musaf, Zichronos, ends by saying, V'akedas Yitzchak lezaro hayom barachamim tizkor. Remember the Akedas Yitzchak for his descendants. And some Rishonim wonder, maybe that's a little bit too open. After all, Esav is also descended from Yitzchak. And so we don't want Hashem to remember the Akedah for all of Yitzchak's descendants. There are some Nuschos, I think Nusach Sfarad is like this, V'akedas Yitzchak lezaro shel Yisrael hayom barachamim tizkor. It does explicate. There are certain Rishonim who said that should be done. But others say no, and it's based on this idea, the Tshuva of the Rivash, that Esav is not part of Zera Yitzchak. Based on this idea, and therefore one can refer to the descendants of Avram or the descendants of Yitzchak. One doesn't need to explicate. One doesn't need to specify which descendants. There's only one line of descendants, as far as the Torah is concerned, and that's Yitzchak is descended from Avram, and Yaakov is descended from Yitzchak, and no one else is in that cheshbon. So that's nogea to the Nusach HaTfilah. But here too, we have an interesting shaila. Why is it that the exclusion of Yishmael as descendant status is explicitly stated? Meaning only Yitzchak and not anyone else? While the exclusion of Esav is much more subtle. It's the letter Beis. B'Yitzchak. We don't find a corresponding thing where Hashem says only Yaakov and not Esav. It's part of Yitzchak, which then is understood as Yaakov and not Esav. But if it's clear, Yishmael is excluded and so is Esav, but they're not excluded in the same way. Yishmael is excluded black on white, and Esav is excluded by a diuk, by a prefix. Why is that so? Says Rav Shor, for a very simple reason. At this time, when these words were said to Avram, it's in Parshas Vayera, Yishmael had already done enough to exclude himself from claiming descent from Avram. Esav had not. Yitzchak didn't have any children yet. And moreover, even as Yitzchak has his two sons of Yaakov and Esav, as the Mefarshim discuss at length, Esav, he's not born condemned to be Esav the Rasha. He's not the same as Yaakov. He has different temperament and different proclivities and different disposition that may well be in a different nature and different trials and tribulations. But if he does the right thing, he would have been part of the Jewish people. That means you cannot exclude in advance Esav because he might not end up being excluded. But you need to provide the basis for where things look like they're headed. And the basis, in this case, is the base. It's the base of ki be Yitzchak, part of Yitzchak. And moreover, and here Rav Shor takes that additional step and says that if one could imagine for a moment, imagine maybe for what is thus unimaginable, but imagine that Esav had done the right thing, had risen above his challenges and become a partner to Yaakov, as Yitzchak really hoped that they would be. Look back now at Hashem's words to Avram. Ki be Yitzchak, Yikar l'chazara. What are you to make of the base? Something else, whatever it may be, it will be then understood as the signal. Things, therefore, once again, the latitude of understanding what's been communicated here is it's left open because it's not explicated. It comes through a base. Yishmael is excluded black on white because it's already done. But the exclusion of Esav has yet to happen, and it might not necessarily happen. It needs to be signaled, but it cannot be more than that. Very similar to the Meshech Chochma here. So a lot to think about in terms of Parshanut, as we look through the Parsha. The central part is really the second half of the Parsha, as we know, is the Tochacha. We read that in always before Rosh Hashanah. It's a Takana of Ezra, the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, Daf Lamed Aleph. Ezra instituted always to read the Tochacha of Kisavo before Rosh Hashanah. And why? Because the Tochacha has curses, dire predictions. We want those predictions to end when the year ends. In the expression of the Gemara, Tichleshana v'kilaloseha, let the year end together with its curses, and therefore that's how the year should end. And then the new year should begin only with blessing. Tochel shana u'birchoseha. This is something which those who say everything on the Machzor, certainly if they start from the beginning, there's a very beautiful piyut at the opening of the Rosh Hashanah Machzor. Some people say it before Ma'ariv and Rosh Hashanah night. It's called Achos Katana, and has three or four stanzas, and the first ones end with Tichle Shana V'Kilosel, that the year end and its curses end, and then the final one ends Tochel Shana U'Birchosel. We don't read the Tochacha in the Shabbos directly before Rosh Hashanah. There's always a buffer week. The Tochacha is always 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. The week before is Nitzavim and Nitzavim Vayelech, as Tosfos say, because we don't want curses to be the final word, and therefore we put it back a week. But that's the idea. And this is certainly, as we hear, the Tochacha, and sometimes you need to pay a bit more attention to the Tochacha, depending on how the Baal Kori reads it, how quickly and how loudly or not loudly. But as we hear the Tochacha, and we have seen many of the curses of the Tochacha, either in our time or previous times, that the idea is the year is coming, as it comes to a close, let it come to a close and leave behind with it all of the klalos, and that the new year bring with it only bracha, tochel shana u'birchoseha b'sha'a tova. Wishing everyone all the best, wonderful evening, and b'seres tovas.